foot in her publisher's office again and conducted her business with her agent over the phone. As time went on, Ronnie decided that the woman she'd been, the author who'd swept through New York City in those high suede boots, hadn't been a good woman. It was more than just what had happened with Gregory. There was also the anecdote she'd lifted, almost unchanged, from a friend's life and used in After Dawn, and the way she'd ignored the now former friend's hurt look when they'd run into each other at a dinner party, and how 2 weeks later, when the woman sent her a letter, Ronnie had shoved it into the back of a drawer, unread. There was the way she'd listened to her sister's dating stories, feigning interest, only because she wanted to glean details from them to use in her fiction. The time that she'd used a particular detail about the way that Lee chewed and given it to the villain in her second book, and how she would encourage her friends to go on second and third dates with guys who were clearly jerks, only because their tales of depredation and heartache lit up the novelist part of her brain. The way she'd started accepting things like first-class plane tickets and pricey hotel rooms and expensive meals as her due, forgetting to be grateful, forgetting how lucky she was. The way she'd sneered at a colleague who'd asked to be introduced to her agent. "God, can you imagine what Alice would do to me if I sent her Martha's manuscript?" she'd laughed to Lee, who'd looked startled. "Maybe she's talented," he'd said mildly, and Veronica had pictured mousy Martha in her shapeless sack-style dresses and her clogs, and sneering had thought, "Probably not," as if she could tell, just by looking, who had talent and who didn't, who deserved luck and good fortune and who did not. Veronica, the author, was arrogant and entitled, demanding and cruel. Saying goodbye to that woman would not be a hardship. Resetting her life, making her teaching and her children and her marriage her priorities, would be a good thing. Veronica's last act as a published author was attending the premiere of The Summer Sisters. The movie still reappeared sometimes, late at night, on obscure cable channels. Ronnie would always flip right past it. She didn't stop writing, but after the babies were born, she'd never tried to publish another word of fiction. When Lee asked her gently if she'd quit because the sales of After Dawn had been disappointing, at least compared to her debut, or if she was sad that the movie hadn't been a bigger hit, or that nothing had come of the second book's option, she'd shaken her head. "I don't feel like I have anything left to say," she told him. "Oh, I don't believe that." "It's fine. I'm fine. I'm happy now," she assured him. The babies and her classes kept her busy. She loved her husband. She'd had her adventures, or rather, Veronica had. Now Ronnie was relatively fulfilled, mostly content. She couldn't go back in time and change what she'd done. She couldn't make it up to Lee because she couldn't tell him what had happened, not ever. What she could do was make a sacrifice. She could give up something that she loved, and in doing so, renounce the last vestiges of that other woman she'd been. She would stop being a novelist and be, instead, a wife, a mother, a professor of literature, a secret scribbler, accumulating stacks of pages that reposed in plastic storage boxes on the top shelf of her closet. She could refocus her energy and her ambition on her home life and on teaching, and she could suffer quietly for the sin only she knew she'd committed. She would be like a medieval penitent with a girdle of thorns under her clothing. No one would know but her. For almost 40 years, Ronnie wore her thorns and wrote in private, and believed herself safe, trusting that what she'd done would stay forever between her and God. She'd written 8 novels, each in its own plastic box, high on a shelf in the guest room, with instructions as to their disposal in the will she'd written 10 years ago. Her kids had grown up, and Lee had died, without suspecting that Ronnie had ever been untrue. she'd had no reason to think that anyone would learn her secret. And now, thanks to faddish DNA kits and her idiot sister, her children and their children were all going to know. She and Paul each had a second glass of wine as the sun went down and the darkness gathered and the wind rose, making conversation with the tall grasses, the rose bushes, the pine trees. They settled on a price, and Ronnie said she'd let him know when she was ready for the listing to go live. "We're having a wedding," she said, and Paul congratulated her and said, "I hope it's a beautiful day." She saw him out, and instead of going to bed, she walked back upstairs slowly, standing in front of the big windows that looked out over the water, for once without noticing the waves or the starry sky. "After the wedding," she told herself. "If Sam and Sarah find out beforehand, if they have questions, I'll get them to wait. I'll tell them we can't ruin Ruby's big day. We'll get through it, and then, when it's over, I'll tell them everything." Part 2. May 2021. The Course of True Love. Interlude. A wedding, thought the house, with a small shudder that made her roof joists groan. A wedding. It should be one of her happiest occasions. But over the previous week, she'd heard what was coming after the last of the confetti was cleared. Too much house, indeed. She was just the right amount of house for a grandmother and parents and children and stepchildren, for cocktail parties and birthday cakes and rainy days of puzzle solving and Scrabble. "You have hurt my feelings," she wanted to tell the lady of the house, but she could sense that the lady would soon be having enough troubles of her own. So, a wedding. The boy and the girl who'd grown up here were a man and a woman now. They would come. They'd see the problem with their mother. They would help. And then, she hoped, they would change her mind. They would realize all that she was and all she had to give them. And they would decide that there was no better house in the world, that there was nothing to do but stay. But first, she'd have to help them. Maybe help their children, too. Whatever obstacles they'd encountered, whatever kept them from being happy, and by extension, from being here with her, she would fix it. She'd clear the path. She'd smooth the way. She'd figure out how, and she'd fix it all. Ronnie started off in the laundry room, gathering a basket of sheets and pillowcases and holding it against her midsection as she set off, with a line from A Midsummer Night's Dream bouncing around in her head. "I am sent with broom before to sweep the dust behind the door." The wedding was still over a month away, but she knew from experience that setting the big house in order would take time, and she wasn't moving as fast as she used to these days. Better to start early, she decided. Her plan was to begin at the bottom of the house and work her way up to the top, determining who would go where. Once she had the sleeping arrangements figured out, she could start to think about meals and pre-wedding activities and, most important, the thing that she was dreading, what she'd say to Sam and Sarah when the wedding was over. There were two bedrooms on the ground floor, one with a single queen bed and a bathroom where long ago the mother's helpers used to stay. The other was a spacious room called the dorm, with three twin beds, each with a trundle. She'd put Sam and Connor in the smaller room. Connor could share a bed with his stepdad, or he could sleep with Miles and Dexter in the dorm, which Ronnie supposed he would probably prefer. She put fresh linens on the beds, then climbed the stairs slowly, thinking as she walked. Normally, she'd put Sarah and Eli and Ruby in the guest house. Sarah and Eli would take the bedroom with its king-sized bed, and Ruby would get the Murphy bed that pulled down from the guest house's living room wall. She'd loved that bed as a kid, Ronnie remembered. picturing Ruby pulling it down, then folding it back, watching as the wood on the bed's base blended in almost invisibly with the wall. "It's like magic," she'd said. But Ruby was the bride now, which meant that she should have the entire guest house. Ruby and her husband-to-be could sleep in the bedroom and keep the living room free for whatever beauty ministrations Ruby and her bridesmaids intended for her big day. Ronnie wasn't sure what Ruby's plans were, if she'd arranged for people to help with her hair and makeup, if she even planned on having bridesmaids or wearing a traditional wedding gown. When she'd offered to help, Ruby had refused. "Don't worry about anything, Softa," Ruby said. "I've got it all under control." Typical Ruby, Ronnie thought. Ruby, like her stepmother, had always been a competent girl, making her own arrangements because she didn't trust anyone to do it as well as she could. Ronnie was musing that it was nice to be a guest in your own home, and how she'd get to be surprised by Ruby's dress, when her phone rang. She set down her laundry basket and pulled her phone out of her pocket. "Speak of the devil," she said to Ruby. "I was just thinking about you." "What were you thinking?" Ruby asked. "About how much you loved the Murphy bed when you were little." "Oh, right," Ruby said. Ronnie could picture her, her ringlets, her pale skin, and her smile. It was like magic. "That's what you'd say." Ronnie stretched from side to side. She'd woken up with her back feeling stiff again. "Did you set up any hair and makeup?" "Yep, called a salon in P-Town. They're sending two people Saturday morning." Ruby paused. "So listen," she said. "I need a favor."
"Sure, what's up?"
Ruby inhaled. "Gabe's mother's coming out."
"To her son's wedding? I should hope so," Ronnie said.
"His mom's bringing her sister, Gabe's Aunt Amanda," Ruby continued. "And the thing is..." Ruby paused. Ronnie waited. "They'll probably get a hotel," Ruby said, her voice rising almost imperceptibly on the word probably. "Except I just went online and everything's sold out. There's nothing left. No hotels, no Airbnbs." Ronnie didn't reply, but what she was thinking was that if Gabe's people hadn't booked something already, there would be exactly a 0% chance of them finding a place. At this point, ahead of a normal summer, everything would be booked, from the budget motels to the high-end bed and breakfasts, and in a world still coming out of a pandemic, when everyone was extra desperate to travel and could only do it domestically, it was even worse. "But just in case," Ruby's words came in a rush, "maybe if Gabe and I stay in the guest house, his mom can crash on the Murphy bed for a night or two." "His mom and his aunt?" Ronnie permitted a little doubt to season her voice. "Do you really want other people in the guest house with you the night before your wedding?" "It'll be fine," Ruby said stiffly. "And they'll be okay sharing a bed?" Ronnie was already trying to remember what had happened to the air mattress she'd used one year when she'd hosted Thanksgiving, and couldn't get out of inviting her sister and brother-in-law and their kids, who were, of course, too cheap to spring for hotel rooms. "I think they're close," Ruby made a scoffing noise, "except I think his aunt's maybe kind of a bad influence. That's what Gabe says." "Well, that's a not uncommon family dynamic," said Ronnie, thinking of her son-in-law and his brother, and about her own sister, who'd convinced her many years ago when they were both teenagers to shave off her eyebrows. They'd never completely grown back either, she thought, with a prickle of irritation. "I'm giving you the entire guest house. Anyone you want to stay there is fine with me," Ronnie said. "Thank you," Ruby said fervently. "Seriously, Softa, thank you so much for all of this."
"Of course."
Ronnie said goodbye, put her phone back in her pocket, and picked up her laundry basket again. She hadn't wanted to ask Ruby if her biological mother, Annette, was planning on coming to the wedding. She still couldn't understand a mother leaving her child. She tried not to judge. Maybe Annette had suffered from postpartum depression, or she'd had some kind of mental health problems. Maybe Annette had just known that she was poorly equipped to be a parent. Better, if that was the case, to leave the job to someone who could do it. Someone who genuinely wanted to be a mom, Ronnie thought. And things seemed to have worked out well for Ruby. Her father doted on her. Sarah loved her and had been happy to step into the role of stepmother. Being raised by a single father for so many years, with a mother out of the picture, hadn't seemed to affect Ruby as dramatically as it could have. Perhaps it was even at the root of her drive. Ruby had always done well in school. She'd had plenty of friends. She'd chosen her career and worked toward it with unwavering focus and unrelenting determination. And now Ruby would be a wife. Ronnie shook her head in wonder, hardly able to imagine the girl she'd met as an 8-year-old becoming someone's wife. She set fresh linens on the guest room bed and sat down on the bench at its foot to catch her breath and call her daughter. Annette? I know that Ruby invited her, Sarah said. Sarah sounded distracted, but that was probably to be expected, with the wedding so soon and with managing the boys' complicated schedule. She told Eli that she was going to try to make it. She's going to try to attend her only child's wedding? Sarah sighed. I know, Mom, I don't understand it either. I'm asking because I need to know if I should save her a bed. Annette can take care of herself. Ronnie could picture her daughter walking at her typically brisk pace, shoulder-length hair swinging. She'll probably pop a tent in the backyard. Well, that would work for me. I've got a nice one in the garage. Are you still planning to come up on Wednesday? Thursday, I think. We'll leave first thing in the morning, probably get to you by mid-afternoon. That's great. Do you know how long you'll be staying? Ronnie kept her tone perfectly neutral, without even the hint of an accusation, but still Sarah managed to hear one. Just until Sunday. I'm sorry, and I wish it could be longer, but Miles has soccer and Dexter's got nature camp, and they both start first thing Monday. Nature camp in New York City, Ronnie thought, instead of letting your kid experience actual nature on Cape Cod. Oh, she'd never understand Sarah, not as long as she lived. I understand. Tell the boys I can't wait to see them. She waited to see if Sarah wanted to keep talking. Some afternoons the conversation would range from Dexter's obsession with turtles to Miles's scathing book reports. In my opinion, this book is bad and boring, and I do not know why it's for sale, was how his assessment of his last book had begun. Or the most recent show that Ruby had stage managed, or the postponed trip that Sarah and Eli were planning on taking when the world allowed for travel again. If Ronnie caught her at the right moment and gave her time, Sarah would start with the family news and work her way to whatever was bothering her. But ever since their talk about the studio she'd rented, Sarah hadn't been chatty, and that morning was no exception. Love you, Mom, but I've got a million things to take care of. We'll see you soon. Sarah hung up the phone, leaving Ronnie to wonder. Sarah had not been herself lately, Ronnie thought, as she made her way across the deck to the guest house. Ronnie had been on the brink of asking Sarah a dozen times, "What is going on?" She'd been ready with advice on the necessity of working at a marriage, the importance of putting your head down to get through the hard times and not throwing love away. She'd even considered calling Eli herself, asking him the same questions. In every instance, she'd managed to keep her mouth shut. Every marriage is a mystery, as her own mother would say. If Sarah needed her help, she would ask for it. Trying to pull Sarah close to her would only send her further away. Ronnie settled her basket in her arms and got back to work. Halfway to the guest house, she had to pause because she developed a painful stitch in her side. It was disheartening. Ronnie could still remember when she could trot up and down the 6 flights of beach stairs with a baby on each arm. Oh well, she thought, setting down her basket, raising her arms over her head and bending from side to side. She could see her reflection in the guest house window. wide-legged cropped cotton pants, one of Lee's old undershirts, bare feet. Wisps of hair had escaped from her bun, and without underwire and shapewear, her middle looked thick, without a noticeable waist or bust line. "You're lovely," Lee used to tell her, "right up until the end, even on the days when all she saw were ruin and sag." "You're lovely," he would say, "still my beautiful bride," and his conviction made it true. Ronnie picked up her basket and continued on, balancing it on her hip as she pulled the sliding door open. The guest house had once been Sam and Sarah's private domain. They'd play house. Ronnie smiled, remembering Sarah at 5 or 6, sitting importantly at the dining room table with a stack of paper in front of her. "Bring me a coffee," she'd tell Sam, with an imperious tilt to her chin that would send her mother's reading glasses sliding down her nose. "Then take the kids to the beach. I am very busy doing my writing." Poor Sam would scurry to obey, filling a mug up with water and saying, "I'm going to be late to work," while Sarah ignored him, scribbling on the pages with a red pen or pretending to take calls from the dean. "I was a good mother," Ronnie told herself. She'd stopped smiling, the memory giving her an unpleasant twinge. She didn't like the idea that all that Sarah remembered was a parent too busy or distracted to notice her. Was that why Sarah never brought her boys out here for long? Was it that all she remembered from their summers in Truro was a mother too busy to give her the attention she needed? Ronnie shook her head. What was done was done. She couldn't change the past or what her daughter felt. Head down, she walked back to the house, barely noticing the sound of the waves or the warmth of the deck beneath her bare feet, as she thought. If Sarah and Eli weren't going to be in the guest house, they'd have to be in the guest bedroom, on the other side of the hall from Ronnie's bedroom. It was a smallish room with a queen-sized bed, and for a minute, Ronnie considered giving up her own room and her larger bed so that her daughter and her 6-foot-tall son-in-law could have more space. She decided against it. Giving Sarah the master bedroom could serve as a reminder to her twin about what he'd had and lost, or worse, it would give Sam evidence that Sarah was Ronnie's favorite. Sam was actually her favorite, but that was a secret she'd be taking to her grave. Ronnie liked her space and her privacy and disliked the thought of having to move her clothes and her makeup and her medications, not to mention the poise pads she'd started to occasionally require. The bedroom still held the ghost of Lee's scent, the strongest echoes of presence. If the upstairs couch had been Ronnie's domain and the guest house had been Sam and Sarah's hideout, this room was Lee's fiefdom. There was a small office set up in front of the window that faced the pool and the meadow, and there was a round cushioned seat, big enough for two, on the deck that overlooked the bay. Dad's tuffet, the kids had called it. On summer afternoons, Lee would head out there with a book, and most of the time she'd find him dozing, the book open on his chest and his glasses askew. Sometimes she'd look out the bedroom window and imagine that she could still see him there, stretched out on the tuffet with the breeze ruffling his hair and a glass of ice water beside him. "This house is full of ghosts," Ronnie thought, and wiped her hands on her legs. Sometimes she almost thought she could hear the house itself talking to her, telling her that Lee was still there, that he hadn't left her, telling her that Sarah and Sam were still little, that they hadn't grown up and left her behind. Ronnie shook her head at her own folly, telling herself she was turning into a foolish old woman. She forced her brain back to the present, reviewing her decisions. Sarah and Eli in the guest bedroom, Sam and Connor and Miles and Dexter downstairs, however they decided to configure themselves, Ruby and Gabe in the guest house, with Gabe's mother and aunt there too, unless she could work some magic and find them a hotel room. Best of all, she could tell Suzanne and Matt that there was no room at the inn, and she wouldn't even be lying. Perfect. Ronnie showered and dressed and drove into Provincetown. She had an appointment at noon for her annual physical at the clinic on Shank Painter Road. Once that was done, she'd go to the Stop and Shop to start stocking the kitchens and to talk to the people at Wildflowers. Cherry blossoms, she thought dreamily. Was the end of June too late for cherry blossoms? Maybe they could cover the banister in pink and white blooms and build centerpieces of blossoming branches. But Ronnie never made it to the supermarket that day. An MRI? Ronnie asked an hour later, hearing the paper of the examination table crinkle underneath her. Really? Really, said Dr. Dominguez. Usually in perpetual motion, hurrying from one patient to the next, the doctor had spent a long time lingering over Ronnie's belly, pressing here, prodding there, rattling off a series of questions. Any unexplained weight loss? Any fatigue? Nausea? Loss of appetite? Blood in her stool? Now she kept her gaze on Ronnie's, making an unnerving amount of eye contact. And right now? It has to be right now? Yes, Dr. Dominguez said. Her tone was soft. Her eyes, cool and gray behind her glasses, gave nothing away. But her doctor was not an alarmist. Ronnie licked her lips. Why do you think there's a mass? Her voice was low and steady, and Ronnie shut her eyes, thinking that this couldn't be good. 2 hours later, Veronica was sitting in the waiting room at Hyannis Hospital. 2 hours after that, she'd been admitted and was lying in a bed with an IV in her arm, pumping her full of, she wasn't entirely sure, what. There was an endoscopy scheduled for later that afternoon and in the morning, should the blood tests and the endoscopy reveal what the doctors thought they would, a consult with an oncologist. Is there anyone you'd like us to call? Asked the nurse. Ronnie shook her head. Not yet, she said, her voice a little faint. Whatever was happening to her, whatever lay ahead, all of it could wait. She wasn't going to spoil Ruby's day. After the wedding, she told herself, there'd be time enough to deal with whatever was coming, to tell whoever needed to hear. Sam. Is this a good time? Sam asked when Sarah answered his call. It was 9:30 in the morning in Los Angeles, 12:30 in New York. Sam had already dropped Connor off at school and put in his hour at the gym. I wanted to ask if you'd figured out when you're heading to the Cape. Sam hoped he sounded casual, like a man with nothing to hide. I'm looking at tickets, and Connor wants to know how long Dexter and Miles will be there. On his phone screen, Sarah's glance slid sideways. The wedding's on Saturday. We'll get there on Thursday. Mom's already leaning on me to have the boys stay for a few weeks. Leave them with me. I'll take care of everything, she said, imitating Ronnie's tone. But the boys have to be back to start their camps Monday morning. I'm trying to figure it out, she said, and sighed. Maybe I'll have Eli take them back and I'll stay with Mom for a while. Sam frowned. This didn't sound normal. Does Eli have time to do all the picking up and dropping off? Sam had only one boy to care for, and Connor wasn't nearly as busy as his cousins. But even soccer practice and games once a week got time-consuming. Eli can figure it out, Sarah said, with uncharacteristic asperity. He knows how to hire a sitter, same as I do. Okay, Sam said. What's wrong? He looked at the screen, at the poster over his sister's shoulder. And where are you? Is that your office? Did you redecorate? Quickly, Sarah shifted the phone so that all Sam could see was her face and a blank white wall. Actually, I rented a studio. The rents are super cheap right now. Everyone left the city during the pandemic, and landlords are practically giving places away. And with Ruby and Gabe in the house, it was feeling so crowded, and I just thought... She stopped talking and sighed deeply. Then she shook her head. I don't want to dump my stuff on you. You've got enough going on. Connor and I are fine, said Sam, who was quietly relieved that Sarah wasn't going to ask about the length of his own stay on Cape Cod. Dump away. Things aren't good, Sarah said, with Eli. Hang on. Sam carried his phone from the kitchen to the living room and took a seat on the couch. What do you mean, aren't good? What's going on?
I don't know, she said. I don't know, and he won't tell me. He's been tuning me out for months, ever since the pandemic started, and I thought things would get easier when he went back to work and the kids went back to school, but it's only gotten worse.
Do you think... Sam started, then he stopped, because he wasn't sure what to suggest. All the possibilities he could think of, Eli using drugs, Eli having an affair, Eli involved in some kind of financial scandal, Eli in trouble at work, seemed equally improbable. Rock-steady, rock-solid Eli, who'd been Sam's role model as he'd taken on the responsibilities of being a stepfather, it was impossible to imagine him making the kind of misstep that would have Sarah sounding so glum. What do you think it is?
I don't know, Sarah said. I just don't know.
She rubbed at her forehead. I'd assume that he was having an affair, except I don't know when he'd have time. He's under my feet every minute of the day, she shuddered. I feel like I'm going crazy. The flip-flops, Sam guessed. I want to burn them, Sarah said darkly, except then the house would smell like burning plastic and he'd probably just buy new ones. Could it be related to money? Asked Sam. Sarah shook her head. I checked. Everything's where it's supposed to be. He hasn't taken anything out of our savings or our retirement funds. She raised her shoulders in a helpless-looking shrug. I don't know. Maybe it's online gambling or porn?
Watching it or making it? Sam asked. Sarah gave a startled bark of laughter. Good God!
Because people are lining up to watch middle-aged periodontists have sex. That would be a very niche market, am I right?
You'd be surprised, mumbled Sam.
Sarah gave him an imploring look. I thought, I don't know, maybe he'd talk to you. I'll try, Sam said. It's what, 5 weeks until the wedding? I'll see him in person and ask what's going on. Thank you, Sarah said. Her voice pitched low. It's been... She bent her head. Sam saw her swipe her eyes and could barely hear her when she said, I've been trying to decide if I should just ask him to move out. Sam felt his face sag in surprise. Sarah and Eli's marriage had always felt as reliable as anything he could imagine, as solid as their own parents' union had been.
It's that bad?
Sarah nodded sadly. Something's got to change. Eli knows he's been awful, and he won't tell me why. He told me he won't even talk about it until after the wedding, and I agreed. I thought maybe he was asking me for time because he wanted to fix whatever's going on, or end it, whatever it is. She raised her hands, then let them fall into her lap. The whole time we were dating, he made me feel like I was the most important person in the world. And now it's like he can't even see me. If I walk into a room, he walks out of it. If I cook dinner, he chews it like it's cardboard. I can't remember the last time he gave me a compliment or looked at me like I mattered to him.
Ouch, Sam murmured.
He knew, maybe better than anyone, that Sarah needed to be seen. She was like their mother that way. Comfortable at the head of a classroom or on stage performing, drawing from the energy of an audience or the admiration of a partner.
He barely talks to me. He looks right through me, and he won't tell me what's going on or why he's acting this way, and I have no idea how to help him, and...
Sarah closed her mouth and raised her chin. I don't want the boys thinking that this is what marriage is supposed to be, or Ruby either, for that matter. I don't want any of them believing that a husband or a wife can just check out emotionally, and the other person just endures it. Sam nodded. I'm sorry, he said. Sarah sniffled. I wish you were still here. I'll see you soon, he promised.
He told her to call him if she needed him, and that he'd do his best to talk to Eli, and ended the call feeling sorry for his sister, puzzled about his brother-in-law, and glad again that she hadn't asked him about his plans or how he was doing, or if there was anything new in his life. After Saul Berenger delivered his ultimatum, and Sam had cleared it with Connor's father, "Yeah, sure, man, whatever works," Jason said after Sam made his pitch. "I mean, I'd take him, but they say that the road ain't no place to start a family, right?" Sam had packed them up and brought Connor to New York for the summer. Sarah and Eli had welcomed Sam, and their sons had been thrilled to have Connor staying in their house. Dexter was almost 7, and Miles was 5, and Connor fit neatly into the boy pack, a loyal and extremely tractable car in what his sister sometimes called the testosterone train. "I am going to pretend they're my big brothers," Connor told Sam, with a delighted expression on his usually somber face, and Sam felt his own heart lifting. He might have screwed up any number of things in his life, but at least he didn't need to second-guess his choice to get Connor away from his grandfather. Sam rented a desk in one of the neighborhood's many shared workspaces and tried to regather the strands of his professional life. Every morning, he and his sister would drop the boys off at the day camp they attended. Then Sarah would take the subway to the music school, and Sam would head to his temporary office, ending his day in time to pick up the boys and escort them all back to Sarah's for a snack. The boys would play or read until dinner. Sam would help with the cooking, and Connor and his cousins would set the table. "Dexter only gets to do the silverware because he always drops the plates," Sam overheard Miles telling Connor. And they'd go around the table with Sarah and Eli, asking each of the boys about the best and worst part of their day. Sam and Connor stayed in the attic, which had been Ruby's domain before she'd gone off to college. Connor spent most of his time on the third floor, where Dexter and Miles had their bedrooms. After 3 weeks, Connor asked Sam if he could have a sleepover in Miles's room. Miles had bunk beds, and he generously offered his step-cousin the lower bunk. "Sometimes I have nightmares," Sam heard Connor explaining in his gravelly voice. "That's okay," Miles had answered, before lowering his own voice to a whisper and saying, "I used to wet the bed." Sam watched over Connor carefully, worrying about the boy's bad dreams and his extremely limited diet. Connor had always been picky, but after Julie's death, his selections narrowed to a tiny list of foods. Chicken nuggets, carrot sticks, macaroni, peanut butter, never crunchy, on bread, always white, grilled cheese sandwiches, cheese sticks, and ice cream. Sarah told Sam not to worry. The pediatrician said, "I promise you, he isn't going to starve. Keep offering him fruits and vegetables and just be patient with him." Sam did his best. He paid careful attention while his sister and brother-in-law gave him an introductory course in the parenting of little boys. Sarah took Sam to Old Navy and talked him through the bewildering particulars of kids' clothing sizes. "How is a 6 different from a 6T?" Sam asked, and Sarah leaned close and stage whispered, "No one knows." Together, Sam and Connor picked out a new backpack, shaped like a stegosaurus, and a duvet cover with a dinosaur print. After his first day of camp, Connor joined his cousins for a play date in Prospect Park. Then a week after that, an invitation to a classmate's birthday party arrived. It seemed like Connor was making friends and settling into the rhythms of a new house. When Sam tentatively asked his sister if she knew of any children's therapists, Sarah had smiled and said, "This is Park Slope. I bet I'd have an easier time telling you the kids who aren't in therapy than the ones who are." "Really?" "Really. Personally, I think Connor's doing fine." Sam sipped his coffee. "Sometimes I hear him crying in the bathtub," he said. Sarah made a face. "Sam, his mother died. Of course he's going to sneak off and cry, and have bad dreams, and pitch a fit if you accidentally give him crunchy peanut butter." She looked at her brother fondly. "I get that it's probably hard to imagine what he's going through, you and I had the most normal childhood in the world.
And I still did some crying in the bathtub, said Sam, remembering being 8 years old when the older boys hadn't let him join their ice hockey game, or 12 when Missy Lopresto had broken up with him the day after agreeing to be his girlfriend because she'd decided she liked Craig Shepherd better. The therapist Sarah eventually found was named Ava Bidwell, and her office was just a few blocks from Connor's camp, conveniently close to an ice cream parlor. Sam and Connor would share a dish of vanilla with caramel sauce after Connor's appointments on Wednesday afternoons, until that particular taste and texture became the taste of mental health. After they'd finished their treat, they would walk back to Sarah and Eli's brownstone together, with Connor's small hand secure in Sam's larger one. By the end of August, Dr. Bidwell pronounced Connor ready to face the world, or at least try whole wheat bread. Sam brought Connor back to California. Maybe someday they would move east for good, but for now he wanted to at least keep Connor in the neighborhood he knew and send him back to the school he'd attended before Julie had died. He found a craftsman bungalow with a guest house in the back, and he and Connor spent 2 8-hour days at IKEA, where they bought a kitchen table and a couch and an entertainment unit and bunk beds like Dexter and Miles had. Sarah helped him equip the house, sending him links to furniture websites and places to buy rugs and towels and dishes and glasses and the 1,000 different things he'd need. Sam found Connor a new therapist and got him signed up for a soccer team and a kids' cooking class that met on Saturday mornings. "Okay?" he asked, after he'd clicked the final buttons for enrollment. "I guess," Connor said. He turned away, then looked over his shoulder as he asked, almost casually, "Only, can't I just stay home with you?" Sam scooped him up, deposited him on the dark blue couch they'd picked out together, and sat down beside him. "I know that you're scared." "I'm not," Connor said unconvincingly. "I just like it at home. I have all my dinosaurs." Back in Brooklyn, Sam had helped him put together a collection of plastic models, a triceratops and a spinosaurus, a brachiosaurus and a T-Rex. "I know," Sam said. "Tell you what, if you do 2 soccer practices and you don't like it, you don't have to keep doing it." Connor considered this. "Can I bring my dinosaurs to practice?" "How about you can bring 1, and maybe we'll keep it in your backpack until practice is over?" Connor considered, then nodded his assent. Sam dropped him off at the first practice, praying it would go well, watching as Connor edged toward a cluster of boys. "Do you like dinosaurs?" he heard Connor ask. 3 small heads had nodded. Sam felt like pumping his fist in exultation as Connor ran over, round face flushed. "Sam, can you get my backpack? They want to see my Spinosaurus." He felt himself grinning as Connor grabbed the beast and raced away. Sam stayed vigilant as the school year progressed, watching Connor for signs of trouble. He mourned Julie. He thought of her constantly as he filled the house with furniture, realizing that the new bed was one they'd never share. The new TV was one she'd never watch with Connor sitting between them for the 100th viewing of Toy Story. He grieved for her, even as their time together started to take on the quality of a dream. If they'd ever fought, he couldn't remember. If there'd been things he hadn't liked about her, he couldn't recall. He kept plodding forward, keeping all his attention on Connor, determined to honor his wife's memory by giving her son a stable childhood and a happy home. In October, he'd called Jason, who hadn't been in touch since they'd returned from Brooklyn. "Hey, listen, if you could just, you know, hang on to him, that would be great," Jason said, as Sam was almost sure he would. "I'm not going to ask you for child support," Sam said. "Good, because I know I'd been kind of running behind, but here's the thing," Sam cut him off. "I don't need money. I just need to know if you want Connor in your life, because if not, I'd like to be his legal guardian." Sam could hear Jason thinking, weighing what he wanted and what Sam would think of him if he asked for it.
"Look, it's not that I don't like the little guy," he began. "It's just, look, I told Julie this. I never wanted a kid. I wasn't ready. She said she'd take care of everything."
"And she did," Sam said. "So will I. You just need to sign the papers."
Jason paused, then said in a grown-up version of Connor's rasp, "I feel like shit, you know? I'm not a bad person."
"Of course not," said Sam. He asked Jason for his address, sent the papers he had drawn up via certified mail, and showed them to Connor when Jason returned them.
"So now you're my dad?" He looked at Sam solemnly, right in the eyes.
"Yes," Sam said. "Now I'm your dad."
Connor threw himself at Sam, wrapping his arms around his waist.
"Good," he said. "Good."
Then he'd pushed his hair out of his eyes. Gotta get him a haircut, Sam thought.
"Can we make another dinosaur this weekend?"
For the entire first year without Julie, Sam didn't even think about dating. Getting meals on the table, doing his job, keeping Connor on track, all of that was enough. Sam and Connor made it through the holidays. The first Halloween without Julie, the first Thanksgiving and Hanukkah, which Connor had never celebrated, and Christmas, which he had. In the spring, Connor turned to Sam one night after dinner, as he was clearing the table and Sam was washing the dishes, and said,
"Sometimes I can't remember Mom's face." His voice was grave. "And I feel sad because it means I'm forgetting her."
Sam went to him and gave him a hug. "We'll never forget her," he said. "And I can show you lots of pictures any time you like." Connor looked at him shyly.
"Do you ever have trouble remembering how she looked?"
Sam kissed his cheek.
"No," he said. "I see her every time I look at you."
Just over a year after that terrible afternoon, the day of the cops and the salmon, which Sam and Connor had never eaten again, Sarah began suggesting it was time for Sam to get back out there. Even though Sam felt no impulse to meet someone new and no idea where he'd find the energy for dating, he agreed with his sister, because it was always easier to agree with Sarah than to argue. When she'd ask if he wanted to meet a nice woman she knew from college, or a woman she'd met in a Pilates class who'd been transferred to California, Sam would say yes and would dutifully go on dates. But the first and second dates never became third dates or led to anything like a relationship. "You're not ready yet," his sister pronounced. Sam figured she was right. He was still mourning Julie, still processing the way his life had been upended. He was also still holding a gigantic grudge against Connor's grandfather, who was alive and well and had, if his boasting could be believed, become a father again at the age of 92.
"Isn't he bedridden?" Marcus asked when Sam relayed the news.
Then he considered, shrugged, and said, "Maybe being in bed all day just means he's halfway there." Sam's realization that something had shifted started to dawn during a phone call one Friday night in early spring. Sarah had been telling a story about how one of Ruby's friends had gone viral for writing dreary stories.
"Dreary?" Sam repeated.
"Ah, you and Connor haven't dipped your toes into the wonderful world of Harry Potter yet, I presume," Sarah asked. Sam admitted that they hadn't, and Sarah explained that the hero and one of the villains in the story were named Harry and Draco, and that people, young women mostly, wrote stories where the two of them were actually in love. "So Dreary is their ship name."
"Ship name?"
Sam was lost.
"Ship, like relationship," said Sarah.
"Draco plus Harry is Dreary."
"Hang in there," she'd said cheerfully. "I'm sure by the time Connor's a teenager, there's going to be completely new slang to figure out."
Later that night, moved by a whim he didn't consider too deeply, Sam typed Dreary into his browser and went tumbling down a rabbit hole of smut. There were thousands of stories, maybe tens of thousands. Some of the stories were silly or poorly written,
or anatomically improbable, even if the lovers were both wizards, which of course meant they contained any number of terrible magic wand puns. But some were well-written and funny and sexy. Sam poked around the website, impressed and a little shocked by the multitude and creativity of pairings and the worlds from which they came. Harry Potter was just the beginning. Sam would have called it the tip of the iceberg if the phrase, just the tip, hadn't already started to sound perverted. If you wanted to read about Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson getting it on, you could. If you wanted a 50,000-word novella about Captain Kirk and Mr. Spock making sweet same-sex love in a villa in New Orleans, it was there. Sam worked his way deeper and deeper into the archives, until he looked up from a story about Frodo and Sam 69ing beside the cracks of doom and realized two things, both of them shocking. The first was that it was 2 o'clock in the morning. The second was that he had an erection. Tentatively, Sam palmed his crotch, rocking his hips forward, pressing into the warmth of his hand, thinking, what on earth? His sex drive had dwindled to practically nil in the months since Julie's death, a phenomenon Sam ascribed to a combination of grief, antidepressants, and parenting a little boy who'd frequently start the night in his own bed and finish it in Sam's. Maybe it wasn't weird that he'd find himself turned on by any kind of X-rated fiction, whether it involved men and women or men and men or a pair of male teenage wizards. Or maybe, suggested a voice in his head, this is what's been missing all those years. This is the thing you never knew about yourself, the blank space you could never fill in. This is what will make the rest of your life make sense. Sam closed his computer. He changed into his pajamas, brushed his teeth, and lay in bed, staring up into the darkness, wondering, was he gay? Was he bi? Was he, oh God, into hobbits? A hobbit sexual? Was that a thing? And if he was gay, how could he have missed it? Unless he was the stupidest person in the world, which at almost 3 in the morning seemed like a real possibility. He wasn't worried about being judged or shunned. His parents were admirably open-minded. His best friend wouldn't care. His sister would just be happy for him. And certainly few people in Los Angeles would be shocked by a gay man, even one as late-blooming as Sam. I'll keep an open mind, he decided. That week, he found himself noticing men in a way he hadn't before. The swell of a mailman's calf as he pushed his cart down the sidewalk, the solid span of a neighbor's chest beneath his golf shirt while he watered his lawn, that one of the other dads in the park had very nice eyes. A month after the night of the hobbits, Sam downloaded the app that every gay man in America seemed to use. He set up an account, first hesitating over a screen name. He settled on Sam I Am 37, then agonizing over how to identify himself, gay, bi, questioning. 38 years old and just realizing that maybe I'm into dudes because I read some Harry Potter fanfic? What was the shorthand for that? He finally clicked questioning, then moved on to his next hurdle, the profile picture. Plenty of men used their faces, others displayed body parts, abs or chests or asses. And when you started perusing the profiles themselves, oh, yep, there they were, the dick pics. After lengthy consideration and a few experimental selfies, Sam posted a full body shot of himself on a hike with Connor. He made sure viewers wouldn't be able to see Connor and that they would be able to see all of his body, in the interest of not misleading anyone or sending anyone home disappointed. 60 seconds after his profile went live, his notifications started chiming. Hey, sexy, said Queers for Fears. Hi, Daddy, wrote Marcos Polo, while TomTom83 just used the waving hands emoji. Haven't seen you before, said someone called, oh God, Dad Bod Fanboy, who was, according to the app, a terrifying 0.1 mile away from Sam, a piece of information that prompted Sam to jump up from his desk, race walk across the room, and yank the blinds down, as if Dad Bod Fanboy might have been crouching in the oleander right under the window. Sam immediately disabled his geographical tag and changed the settings to show that he was offline. But he kept scrolling. Young men, older men, men who identified as gay and queer and bi and pan and poly, bearded men with bellies, clean-shaven men with eyeliner. A panoply of men, an endless buffet. "You can do this," Sam told himself. He found a man whose profile said he lived in the valley and who was a few years older than Sam, a man who'd used a picture of his face and not a body part to introduce himself to the world. The man's name was Tim. He was more pleasant-looking than handsome, in a baseball cap that could have been covering a bald spot and a plaid shirt that did not look like it was disguising a six-pack. After long moments of agonizing, Sam typed, "Hi." "Hi yourself," Tim wrote back. "Looking for company?" Well, thought Sam, at least company was less explicit than some of what had already been proposed. He typed, "No, at least not yet. I'm very new at this. It's my first time using this app, actually. I've only ever been with women, but..." He paused, and Tim jumped into the silence. "You're curious?" "Yes," Sam typed gratefully. "I don't want to lead you on." "No worries," said Tim. "If you need someone to hold your hand, I've been out since I was 13 and could probably use the karma points. Want to jump on the phone?" Sam agreed. 10 seconds later, his phone lit up, and a warm male voice was on the other end. "Sam?" "Thank you for doing this," he blurted. His palms and the small of his back were sweaty, and he felt like he couldn't quite catch his breath. "This is probably ridiculous, someone just figuring out he's maybe attracted to men at my age." "Sexuality's complicated." Tim sounded cheerful and perfectly unfazed. "Don't feel ashamed. People figure out they're into all kinds of things at every age. Some people never manage to figure out what they like at all." "That's..." Sam tucked his phone under his chin to dry his hands on his jeans. "That's sad." "It is," Tim agreed. "And I always thought that people who were gay, well, at least men who were gay," Sam amended, "they figure it out early." "Some do. Maybe most do, but not everyone." Sam braced himself for questions about when he'd known and what he'd known and inevitably how he'd known. He was trying to figure out how to spin the Harry Potter piece of his gay origin story, but Tim seemed to sense his discomfort. "So what do you do?" he asked. Sam told him. He learned that Tim managed an upscale Italian restaurant in Beverly Hills, that he was the middle of three children, that his older sister and younger brother were both fine with his sexuality, and that his parents, after some initial resistance, had come around. Tim had been with his partner for 15 years, which comforted Sam, as did the news that their parting had been amicable. "And so here I am, back on Grindr," Tim said, his voice good-natured. "Do you want to meet? Grab a drink? No pressure," he added. "If you decide you don't want this to be romantic, we can just talk." In the interest of full disclosure, Sam told Tim that he was widowed, that he had sole custody of a stepson, and that he also was on antidepressants, which could make orgasms elusive. "I'm really selling myself," he concluded, and Tim laughed and said, "At least you've got your teeth." He paused. "You do have your teeth, right?" Sam assured him that he did, and they agreed to meet at a coffee shop that Saturday, when Connor would be at his cooking class. For the next 3 days, Sam was anxious and distracted. He couldn't decide if he was actually going to go through with this. When he decided that he was, he had no idea what to wear. He wanted to ask Sarah, but he knew he wasn't ready for that conversation. So he finally settled on his newest jeans and a button-down that Julie had once told him brought out the green in his eyes.
On Saturday morning, he made sure Connor got out of bed on time. He fed the boy breakfast and got him into the car a half hour before they normally left, just in case there was traffic. "Are you okay?" Connor asked, as Sam fidgeted, drumming his fingers on the wheel. "Is something wrong?"
No, I'm just..."
"Just what?"
"I'm meeting someone new while you're in class."
"Making friends is scary," Connor said solemnly, and unzipped the backpack he carried with him everywhere, rooting around, finally producing his stegosaurus.
"Here, you can take him. If you need something to talk about, just ask if the other boy likes dinosaurs."
Sam thanked him. He slipped the dinosaur into the glove compartment, sent Connor off to class, and got to the coffee shop 10 minutes ahead of time, approaching the door with his heart fluttering madly, a little bird trapped in his throat. He got a coffee, found a table, and watched the entrance, feeling his armpits prickling, trying not to panic, telling himself that he had nothing to be afraid of, that it was just a conversation with a man, like thousands of conversations with hundreds of men that he'd had in his life. A few minutes later, Tim arrived, greeting Sam with a wave and a smile. He wore jeans and a plaid shirt. Without a baseball cap, Sam could see that his light brown hair was thinning and that his teeth were a little crooked, but when he smiled, he was very appealing. "Could I kiss him?" Sam wondered. "Could I kiss any guy? And why am I assuming that he'd even want to kiss me?"
"You made it," Tim said, offering his hand.
Sam swallowed hard as he tried to tell if the touch of the man's hand made him feel anything. "Did you think I wouldn't show?" Tim's eyes crinkled at their corners. "I figured there was a chance. What can I get you?" Sam indicated his coffee. "I'm fine for now."
"Okay, be right back."
He got in line. Sam's heart thumped even harder. Was he supposed to offer to buy the drink? What was the etiquette here? Had he screwed things up already?
"You look," Tim observed as he came back with his coffee and took a seat, "like you're about to pass out."
Sam exhaled in a rush. Tim patted his shoulder. "Breathe," he said. Sam felt relief, but no particular spark at the touch, and wondered if he'd been wrong about the whole thing.
"So," said Tim, "you grew up in Boston, right? How'd you end up in L.A.?"
Sam told him his story, UC Berkeley, Marcus, Julie, and Connor, and what his life was like now. Tim told him about his year in art school in Miami, my misspent youth, before he'd gone into hospitality. They talked about sports and their favorite hiking trails in Los Angeles, and then somehow a pleasant half hour had passed. Tim was easy to talk to, with a sharp sense of humor and that appealing smile. The longer they talked, the more relaxed Sam felt. When Tim asked if he wanted to walk a little, "There's a park nearby," Sam checked the time, then agreed. As soon as they'd made it outside, he felt his fears returning. The sun felt too bright and the world felt crowded. Moms pushed double-wide strollers, kids ran up and down and over an elaborate wooden climbing structure, chasing each other in games of tag. Tim and Sam sat on a bench.
"So," Tim said, "what do you think?"
"About?" Tim put his hand on Sam's shoulder, eyebrows raised. Sam could feel the weight of the other man's palm, the press of his fingers.
"Can I kiss you?"
Sam hesitated, thinking. Then he told himself not to think, to just try for once to feel. He nodded. Tim's palm slid up to Sam's jaw. Sam felt his face cupped in a hand that was bigger and stronger than any hand he'd ever felt there before. And then Tim was kissing him. Sam could feel the familiar sensation of warm lips and the novelty of stubble. The way Tim smelled like male sweat and some subtly spicy cologne. He felt the other man's lips move against his. Then Tim pulled away, with a teasing crinkle around his eyes. "So, what's the verdict?" Sam found that he was smiling and that his knees were wobbling.
He was feeling the strangest rush of contradictory emotions, fear and arousal, confusion and excitement, all at the same time. His belly was full of butterflies. His feet were shuffling, antsy, ready to run. Tim sat, regarding him calmly, waiting for an answer.
Huh, Sam managed.
Wow. Tim smiled and thumped him on the back. Welcome aboard, baby gay. Sam and Tim quickly realized that they were going to be friends and not lovers. And Sam's next attempt at meeting someone a few months later was considerably less successful. When Connor agreed to spend a Saturday night with the one babysitter he liked, Sam and Tim had gone to a dance party, an underground bash held in what was literally a bar's basement. Sam had presented his proof of vaccination, gotten his hand stamped, then stood in a corner staring as less than a foot away men in underpants made of less cloth than their face masks and body glitter were gyrating on platforms. This is how men our age meet each other, he yelled to Tim, hoping the other man could read lips. Tim assured him that, indeed, this was how men their age met each other, especially the ones who don't like the apps. He swore that Sam's age wouldn't be a problem, and that, in fact, the world was full of men looking for daddies, Sam cringed, bears and silver foxes. Sam did not believe he fit into any of those categories. He wondered what animal he was. A frightened groundhog? An extremely shy otter? Definitely something that was timid. Something hairy, for sure, because while he didn't object to some judicious trimming, Sam wasn't up for anything involving hot wax. At least, not yet. At the club, the bass notes were making his fillings shiver. I'll get us drinks, Tim shouted, and Sam nodded and went to stand in the corner, where for 15 minutes he marveled at the beautiful boys in Speedos and N95 masks, waving their arms and singing along to Lady Gaga, delighting in the night, in the music, in their own freedom. He realized too late that he was staring when one of the beautiful boys approached him. Want to dance? Before Sam could answer, the boy had grabbed his arm and dragged him out on the dance floor, where, in his jeans and New Balance sneakers, Sam felt as conspicuous and ungainly as a fire hydrant plopped down in a field of lissom waving reeds. He did his best to move with the music. The boy spun around, waving his arms in the air before attaching his backside to Sam's midsection, leaving a smear of glitter on Sam's polo shirt. When the song changed, the boy grabbed Sam's hand. Want to go outside? He mouthed. Sam scanned the crowd frantically looking for Tim, but his friend had disappeared, and the boy was tugging him insistently toward the door. Sam followed him out into the night and down into a parking garage. His ears were still ringing from the music. The night air was soft around them, and everything felt dreamlike, not quite real, as the young man unlocked a car and climbed into the back seat. Sam climbed in beside him. The boy pulled off his mask and fell on him, like he was a zombie and Sam the last meal he'd ever eat. His mouth was on Sam's neck, then his ear, then back at his mouth. His tongue demanded entry, pressing and prodding and finally plunging as he slipped one of his hands up Sam's shirt and tweaked his nipple. Sam squirmed away, trying not to giggle, because that had been Sarah's particular torture when they'd been little and Sam had displeased her. Ooh, the boy breathed. Ow, Sam said. The young man was undeterred. Hey, Sam managed as he felt fingers on his zipper. Hey, could you... Too late. The boy wrenched his zipper down, and then his mouth was on Sam's startled but not entirely disinterested penis. The young man was good at this, taking Sam's entire length down the warm tunnel of his throat, his tongue making practiced swoops along the way. All of that would have been fine if the suction hadn't been so insistent, quickly becoming just short of uncomfortable. "Hey, could you please?" There was no way Sam was realizing that you could complain about a blowjob and not sound ungrateful. He squeezed his eyes shut and concentrated as hard as he could on his favorite snippet from Pornhub. There was an older man, maybe in his 50s, with silvery hair and a beard, and a younger man, dark-haired and slender. The older man had attended to the younger with an attention just short of worshipful. He'd undressed the young man tenderly, telling him how handsome he was, how beautiful. And then the young man had undressed the older one, revealing a mat of springy gray chest hair, caressing him slowly. For a long time, they just kissed, lingeringly and lovingly. It was like a scene from Greek mythology, like Narcissus twined around a statue of Zeus. That was what Sam wanted. That, not this platinum-haired, Hoover-throated sex demon who still had Sam's now mostly flaccid penis down his throat and showed no signs of letting go. Finally, the boy pulled off with a wet pop. "Hey, you need a pill?" he asked. "I can..." "No," Sam's voice sounded sharper than he'd intended. He tried again. "No, I'm sorry, I was... He started over. "I don't think this is what I want right now. I mean, maybe if we got to know each other a little better." The young man was staring at him, his expression as puzzled as if Sam had started speaking in tongues. "We could go out to dinner," Sam said, "or a drink, or we could..." The young man smiled, not unkindly, and touched Sam's cheek. "You want a relationship," he said. Which was true, except he said relationship the way Sam would have said incurable herpes. "That's cool. Good luck." He patted Sam's cheek again, then turned and hopped nimbly out of the car, heading back toward the party, leaving Sam to sit there, amused and dumbfounded, trying to understand this new revelation, which was that he was interested in men, but not just to have sex with. He wanted someone to love. And now, maybe it was already too late. Maybe he'd missed his chance. He had wasted his 20s and most of his 30s being oblivious, and now it was just never going to happen. After the wedding, Sam thought, tucking himself back into his pants and climbing out of the car. After the wedding, Sarah and Eli and the boys would go back to New York, and Sam and Connor would stay on in Truro. Maybe he'd try telling his mother his news and see how that went over. Then at night, after Connor was sleeping, he'd go to Provincetown, one of the great gay meccas of America. He pictured himself with a fresh haircut and a Tim-approved outfit, walking along Commercial Street, locking eyes with someone handsome and kind and funny and interesting. He would look at this man, and the man would look at him, and just like that, they'd know. No awkward groping, no confusion, no strange mouths on his genitals. Just the faceless, gorgeous man of his dreams, who would see Sam and know him and desire what Sam desired and want the same things for himself. Sam snorted to himself, thinking that this was as much of a fairy tale as anything Walt Disney had ever put on screen. Love didn't work that way. Sex didn't either. But Sam decided in the handful of weeks between now and his niece's wedding, he would allow himself to hope. Sarah. 6 weeks before the wedding, on a gorgeous day in May, Sarah and Eli and Ruby had an appointment at a caterer's showroom. Ruby and Gabe made a list of their favorite dishes, and Diana, the manager of a restaurant in Provincetown called Safe Harbor, had helped them craft a menu for the wedding night. After the ceremony, waiters would circulate with past appetizers, including options for Ruby's vegan friends, and there'd be a raw bar with oysters and fresh shrimp. For dinner, the guests would enjoy salads of fresh local greens, with candied pecans and goat cheese from one of the nearby dairies, then grilled striped bass and rice pilaf or beef Wellington, Ruby's old favorite, with sour cream whipped potatoes. There would be a selection of cheeses, then miniature desserts, and at midnight, a truck serving hot donuts to the revelers. Diana, who had once been Sarah and Sam's babysitter for the summer, and who'd lived for a time in a cottage that Sarah's mother owned, had flown down from Boston to show Ruby tablecloths and napkins, china and crystal. All the stuff you need to see in person, Ronnie said, and have her sample wedding cakes. Sarah was glad to be out of the house, happy to feel useful to her stepdaughter, delighted as always for a reason to wear something that wasn't a hoodie and pajama bottoms. She'd chosen a cream-colored silk blouse with lavish ruffles at the sleeves, slim-fitting black twill pants, and for a pop of color, pointy-toed pumps in hot pink. Her favorite necklace, a rough chunk of topaz on a fine-link gold chain, hung around her neck. A gold cuff bracelet sat on her wrist, and she dabbed perfume behind her ears. Once Eli would have looked her over with approval, or even pulled her back down to bed and made them both late for work. But it had been weeks since the last time they'd made love, and Sarah couldn't recall the last time Eli had paid her a compliment, which was somehow even sadder. That morning, he hadn't even been there to see her. "If you won't tell me what's going on, I think you should sleep somewhere else," she'd said, after that morning where she'd found him almost crying in front of his tie rack. She'd hoped an ultimatum would finally get him talking. Instead, he'd just given her a sad nod, gathered his blankets and pillow, and moped his way to the attic. He'd slept there ever since. Ruby, on her lunch hour, bounded into view right on time, with an enormous black iced coffee in her hand and a clipboard tucked under her arm. Sarah looked at her stepdaughter, feeling her heart expand, and her anger at Eli evaporating instantly, replaced by a fierce and protective love. Ruby wore a red t-shirt, denim overalls, and black Keds. A few curls had escaped from her ponytail to bounce around her cheeks. Sarah opened her arms and hugged her hard. She adored her sons and loved being a mother of boys, but there was something special about a daughter, and Ruby had been that to her. Together, they'd seen musicals. Too much singing, Eli would grouse, and had gone thrift shopping and watched hours of trashy reality TV. They'd made dozens of trips to museums and hundreds of batches of chocolate chip-studded pancakes. The two of them were the family's early risers, and they'd spent many Sunday mornings together, frying bacon and mixing batter in the quiet kitchen in the hush of a city still sleeping. "Have I told you how lucky I am to be your stepmom?" Sarah asked, with her arms still wrapped around Ruby. Ruby stood on her tiptoes, rocking back and forth as Sarah held her. "I'm lucky to have you, too." They were both a little teary when Diana came out of the building and stood blinking owlishly in the sunshine. She wore a black pantsuit, a white t-shirt underneath, and the same Keds as Ruby's on her feet. Her dark hair was pulled back in a low bun, and the corners of her eyes crinkled as she looked at Sarah. "My goodness," she said, "you're a grown-up." "It happens to the best of us," Sarah said, studying what she could see of Diana's face and trying to connect it back to the girl who'd been a teenager during her summer in Truro. She knew that eventually her mom had sold Diana the cottage on the dunes, which had undergone two additions and was now barely a cottage at all. Sarah's sense was that something had happened to Diana that summer on the Cape, and that Ronnie felt responsible somehow. Sarah thought that Diana looked like an accomplished professional, the owner of one of the most acclaimed fine dining spots on all the Cape, and Sarah could see a diamond wedding band on her left hand. If she'd had troubles, Diana seemed to have put them behind her. "You're my bride?" Diana asked, and when Ruby nodded, she'd bumped Ruby's elbow, then Sarah's. "Come on in. Everything's ready." She looked around. "Are we waiting for a third?" "I think your dad got stuck at the office," Sarah told Ruby, as Diana led them through the high-ceilinged room where two tables were waiting.
She'd reminded Eli of this appointment before she'd left the house, and she'd texted him another reminder an hour ago. Now, this is the gold damask with the sheer overlay, and then we have the maize linen with the crimson runner. I wanted you to see them both in the sunshine, Diana said. Ruby touched the edge of the first tablecloth, then looked at Sarah. Should we wait for Dad before we decide? I'm not sure he's going to have strong opinions, but I'll call him, Sarah said, and thought, I'll kill him. If he's forgotten about this, if he lets Ruby down, I will kill him. While Ruby and Diana talked through the merits of the different shades and fabrics, Sarah called Eli, and when her call went straight to voicemail, she did her best to sound calm. Ruby and I are here with Diana. I hope you're on your way. 30 minutes later, Ruby had decided on the tablecloths and on the china and crystal and flatware. The three of them sat at the first table, and Diana pulled up photographs of the Cape House on her iPad to take them through what she called the run of show. Such a beautiful house, Diana murmured, as the first picture popped onto the screen, a shot taken from the living room looking out at the deck and the water. So I'm thinking cocktails in the living room an hour before sunset. Then we go out to the deck for the ceremony, and then, Diana swiped, and Sarah heard Ruby sigh happily at the image of a long table running the length of the deck, draped in a shimmering pale gold tablecloth. Votive candles twinkled in the twilight, and low bouquets of orange and gold roses stood at regular intervals. When it gets dark, we'll have fairy lights on a trellis. She swiped again, showing Ruby another picture, and Ruby sounded awed when she said softly, "It's so beautiful." "I do love a decisive bride," Diana said, with the corners of her eyes crinkling. "That's our Ruby," said Sarah, as she texted Eli again, while Diana sent the pictures to Gabe and to Veronica. Now for the fun part. Diana hurried away and came back with a tray bearing dozens of slivers of different flavors of cake. She just poured them glasses of water when Eli finally arrived. His hair was disheveled and his expression was confused. "Did you start without me?" "You're almost an hour late," Sarah said. Eli frowned, shaking his head. "It was entered in my calendar for 1 o'clock. I don't know what happened." "Never mind," Sarah said, trying not to glare. "You're just in time for dessert." Eli sat, and Diana passed around the first sample. "This is our classic yellow cake with buttercream frosting." Eli chewed, swallowed, patted his lips with his napkin, and said, "Tastes like a winner to me." "It's good," said Ruby, looking thoughtful. "Just maybe a little," Sarah said, boring at the same instant that Ruby said basic. They laughed together. Diana nodded. Eli looked puzzled. "How about chocolate? That's your favorite, right?" he asked his daughter. "Chocolate cake with chocolate icing?" "Yes, Dad," Ruby said, rolling her eyes. "When I was 6, Eli frowned. "You don't like chocolate anymore?" "Let's try this one," said Diana, reaching for fresh forks. The poor woman, Sarah thought. She'd probably navigated through hundreds of dysfunctional family quarrels. Then the thought hit her like a poison dart. Were they a dysfunctional family? She'd never thought of them that way. Blended, yes. Dysfunctional, absolutely not. She felt herself drooping and tried to sit up straight, to look cheerful, to smile for Ruby's sake. "Here we are," Diana said. "Lemon pound cake with a raspberry buttercream filling and coconut frosting." They ate their samples, sipped ice water, debated the merits of fondant versus buttercream, and discussed how many layers made sense. Or rather, Sarah and Diana and Ruby debated and discussed. Eli kept his eyes down, shoveling cake into his mouth like he was being paid by the forkful, chewing and swallowing and barely saying a word. "They're all good," he said, when Ruby asked, and he didn't seem to notice her wounded expression, which of course made Sarah want to hurt him. "Ruby is your only daughter, and, God willing, this will be her only wedding. How can you do this to her?" After 15 minutes, he pulled out his phone poked at its screen and muttered something about an emergency root canal. "Sorry," he said, reaching for his briefcase. "Time and toothaches wait for no man." Sarah and Ruby watched as he walked to the door. When Diana gathered the forks and plates and whisked them away, Ruby looked at her stepmother. "Is something going on with Dad?" Again, Sarah made herself smile. She wouldn't worry Ruby, not with her wedding so soon. "He's watching his little girl grow up," she said. "I think all fathers struggle with that." Ruby nodded sagely. "Gotcha," she said. She gave Sarah another hug, shook Diana's hand, and went bouncing back to the subway. Sarah walked slowly uptown, back to work, trying to put the unpleasantness with Eli out of her mind. Outside the school, she pulled on her mask and walked up the stairs, past a class of preschoolers carefully making their way down one step at a time. Every day, the building was full of little kids from nearby preschools who'd come to bang on bongos and shake maracas and rain sticks, dance and stomp and learn about rhythm and melody and how to make music. Sarah was glad to have them back, was lucky to be there herself. After a year of dealing with the difficulties of virtual lessons, the glitchy platforms, the overloaded internet, the digitally clueless instructors, and the kids who had to share their tablets or smartphones with parents or siblings, everyone had been delighted to resume in-person study, even if it meant uncomfortable masks, endless hand-washing, and sanitizing the keys on 20 pianos 8 times a day. "I'm lucky," Sarah told herself. No one in her family had gotten sick. She hadn't had to watch a loved one being hospitalized or, God forbid, dying. Everyone was healthy, and there was a wedding coming up. Lucky, she thought, and walked inside. At 5 o'clock, Sarah was walking to the subway with her mask looped around her wrist. Part of her mind was on an upcoming, please God, in-person fundraiser, which would be held outdoors in Gramercy Park. One of their wealthy donors had a key. Part of her was, as always, trying to solve the puzzle of what was wrong with Eli, simmering with anger that he wouldn't just tell her. Yet another part was trying to figure out how she could smuggle a new dress for Ruby's wedding into the house without attracting Eli's attention or censure. "More clothes? Really? You've got so many dresses." It was so unfair, she was thinking, when she heard someone come up behind her and a familiar voice calling her name. "Sarah? My God, Sarah Weinberg?" She didn't answer. Instead, she just stopped, right in the middle of the sidewalk, and closed her eyes. It seemed that her body had recognized his voice before her brain did, as if something deep inside of her on a molecular level remembered it, remembered him. For a minute, she didn't want to turn around. She didn't want to look and see what 20 years had done to her first love. She didn't want him seeing what those years had done to her. She heard him moving toward her, that familiar, sure-footed tread. When she'd known him, the summer they were both 18, Owen had been an athlete, a standout soccer and lacrosse player. Once she dared him to swim butterfly across the length of Slough Pond. She'd tread water in the shallows, watching the graceful rise and fall of his torso and arms. He'd been maybe 50 yards from the shore when he'd taken a deep breath and slipped beneath the surface. She remembered his dark head popping out of the water, his wet hair clinging sleekly to his skull, his face beaded with water, inches from her own. On the sidewalk, Owen touched her shoulder. Sarah turned and opened her eyes. In that first glimpse, it seemed that he hadn't changed at all. He'd filled out some since he'd been a teenager, gotten more solid. His skin was rougher, more wrinkled, and there were threads of silver in his dark hair. But his face, his smile, his eyes. "Sarah," he said. "Wow, hi." Sarah's heart stuttered. She felt unbalanced, flushed and dizzy, and she could tell that he knew what she was feeling. It had always been like that between them. He'd always known.
"Don't ever play poker," he used to tell her. "Everything you're thinking, it's right there on your face."
She cleared her throat.
"Owen, my goodness."
She tried to draw the armor of wife and mother and successful professional around her, even as her traitorous mind jumped to think of what else had happened on the day of the dare.
"I'll bet you can't make it the whole way across Swimming Butterfly," she'd said, and Owen had given her his easy smile and said, "If I do it, what's my prize?"
Sarah curled her toes hard into the soles of her shoes, hoping the discomfort would bring her back to the present, away from herself at 18 and the memory of gleaming young bodies in the water. She smoothed her hair and cleared her throat again.
"I didn't know you were in New York."
She hadn't known anything about him. They hadn't spoken since that summer had ended, and he'd dumped her via email, and, in spite of her entreaties, had refused to call or write and tell her why.
"And you've been here how long? Since college?"
"Since college," Sarah confirmed.
"How about you? Do you live here now?"
She longed for the answer to be yes. She also feared it. Owen that close. Owen in her city, with Eli barely making eye contact with her these days, was a dangerous situation. Owen rolled his shoulders, a gesture she remembered.
"For the next 6 months.
I'm on assignment."
"Doing what?"
"I'm an FBI agent."
"You are?
Want to see my badge?" When he reached into his back pocket, his shirt and jacket pulled tight against his chest, Sarah forced herself to look at his face as he pulled out his wallet and showed her his badge, then extracted a business card which had his name, Owen Lassiter, and the FBI's logo. She ran her thumb over the embossing, with a sensation of the air being too thin, of the world subtly tilting. When she and Owen had been teenagers, they'd told each other their secret ambitions, their most grandiose hopes and unlikeliest dreams. Sarah told him how she'd wanted to be a concert pianist, even if she'd already put that dream aside, unwilling to hang her whole future on the vanishingly slim possibility that she was talented and hardworking enough to rise above the rest of the would-be stars. Owen had wanted to be a writer, a journalist like Sebastian Younger or John Krakauer, who would travel the world covering wars and disasters and sporting competitions. "But I'll probably end up in law school," he'd glumly concluded. "The FBI," Sarah said to Owen. It made sense, she realized. Owen had always loved superhero movies and westerns, and maybe his chaotic childhood, his multiply married parents, might have drawn him to the black and white dichotomies of law enforcement. She couldn't stop looking at him, comparing the man on the sidewalk to the boy who lived in her memories.
"No law school?"
"Yes, law school, but no office job, thank God." He gave her a grin. "This is a lot more fun." He smoothed his tie, his eyes on hers. He was looking at her, she thought, like he knew exactly how she looked without her clothes, which he did. Although her body, after two kids, was a long way from the body he'd remember, Sarah thought, and spared a moment of anger at the idea that she'd ever found flaws in herself when she was 18.
"What about you?" asked Owen. "Music?"
"Music school administration," she said, and hoped it didn't sound as pathetic out loud as it did in her head. "I like it. I used to teach, but it turns out what I really like is developing a curriculum and doing outreach in the community, figuring out how to make lessons and instruments accessible to anyone who wants them. And there's the fundraising," she made herself stop talking.
"I always thought I'd see you on stage," Owen said.
Sarah felt her heart expanding, her face heating with embarrassment. She shook her head.
"You were so good," said Owen.
She waved the compliment away.
"I wasn't."
"You were, though."
"Agree to disagree," Sarah said,
and wondered for the 100,000th time how far she could have gone if she hadn't given up,
if she just kept trying.
"Do you live nearby?" Owen was still looking at her, pleasantly but intently.
Sarah felt her palms start to itch. It's not fair, she thought, looking at his face already tanned, his hands, the dark hair on his wrists. Why does he still have to be hot? Couldn't he have looked old or completely unappealing? Couldn't he have shown up with some disfiguring rash or a really unfortunate mustache?
Except she suspected that even an Owen with pustules or weird facial hair would still look good to her. He would still be the first boy she'd ever loved.
"I have a studio here, but I live in Brooklyn, Park Slope." She made herself lift her chin, forced herself to say the rest. "My husband and I have two boys, plus a stepdaughter." Then, without her planning on it, her biggest question, really,